Welcome to the Fourth Node Podcast. This episode today was a fun one. When we kicked off the idea and started doing research, one of the names that came up very, very early was Corinne Clark, which is who we have on the podcast today. And she's an absolute pioneer in the space. She's been at some of these companies we've talked about. She's been at a couple of companies we haven't talked about. But it was super fun to kind of get her read on a lot of these other podcast episodes that we've been in on.
Yeah, we hit a couple of fun topics. You know, we've covered like some of the early big companies like, you know, Novell and WorkPerfect. And then everyone knows the current big companies, you know, kind of started with Omniture and then Qualtrics and, you know, companies like Entrata.
Yep.
There was kind of this 10-year gap in the middle where a lot of those companies I feel have been forgotten. And one, probably the biggest, was Alteryx, which a lot of Novell people went to start. Went public at a crazy time at the bottom of the market, had like a tumultuous ride as a public company, but eventually got acquired for like $1.2 or $1.3 billion by Symantec. So it was fun to start to hear the stories around that company as well.
The one thing I never pulled apart when we were talking to her, how big as far as revenue was Alteryx?
I think it was like $400 or $500 million in revenue.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And mostly built through a partner network. It was built in a pretty unique way.
Wow.
And then also it was fun to talk to her about just being, you know, really one of the first female leaders yep. in tech, not just in Utah, but really anywhere.
She had really cool perspective on it too. And, you know, she's one of the leaders, not even in the state, but she is very front and center in the state, who kind of hangs around and helps guide and really kind of usher the future of tech with a lot of the other big names that you always hear about. You know, I think she's the chairwoman for Domo. She sits on a lot of the different boards around economic opportunity here in Utah, Silicon Slopes, a handful of others. And she's just done a really, really nice job of not only just furthering tech here in the state or more broadly in the industry, but really kind of showing kind of her path and showing how, you know, even if it was difficult, how she's kind of ushered in women in tech, which I really respect and love.
Yeah, she's got some great stories. She did a great job. This was a fun one.
All right, let's get into it.
Welcome to the Fourth Node Podcast. My very good friend, Corinne Clark today.
Oh, I just love you, Adam.
Love you.
You know
excited
that.
To discuss many things with you today. Well, why don't we have you introduce yourself? But you're also going to help us introduce a company that I don't think a lot of our listeners really know anything about, and that is Alteryx, which was a big part of your career. And that's actually when we met, is when you were at Alteryx.
That's
but
right.
Before we get to that, why don't you just tell us a little bit about you?
Well, what about me? I'm kind of like, I always joke I'm Forrest Gump. I'm like nobody, but I'm in the pictures. So my name's Corinne Clark. Right now I'm the Chief Innovation Officer at Lumio. If you know me, you know that I do lots of different things. I do lots of things that I like to do. My side hustles, I'm also the Chairman of the Board for Domo. People usually gasp when I say that. I'm like, yes, a girl is okay. I'm on the Silicon Slopes Board. I am the Chair of the Governor's Office of Economic Economic Opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I have a bunch of other boards that I help a lot of schools, help a lot of entrepreneurs. That's what I love to do.
You do a lot of mentoring too, that you do kind of as a side hustle. I know that as well.
Yes. And I do love that. And yeah. People say, why do you help these young millennials? Why do you help these students? Well, because we have to, first yeah. of all. And I think even you asked me that a long time ago, like, what are you doing talking mm-hmm. to these classes? And now you have that fever. Mm-hmm. So you're talking to them all the time. I already know I'm going to die. So I have to leave a legacy of talent that works beautifully without me. And because I've been doing it for so long, so many young people come up to me when they see me later and they say, you don't even realize, but you convinced me to get my MBA, or you pushed me to start this company, or you helped me get funding. And that's so rewarding for me. So it's a selfish thing, really.
Those are fun notes to get, especially when it's years later and like all this growth has happened. And they, you know, obviously it wasn't you, but being a part of the story is really fun.
Yeah. I love that.
Okay. So... why don't you tell us about your first job? You started at Novell was kind of where you got your you set your roots. We we've already had Drew and David Bradford on here. They kind of talked about the early, early, early days. What year was it that you entered Novell?
1988.
And kind of what was going on? Okay, so 88. So still with kind of the original exec team, pre-WordPerfect. What was that ride like for you? What was your first job? What was, you know, your time like there?
So I was working at the Brigham Young University Library as a paraprofessional. I thought I was going to be a librarian.
Right.
Yeah. And because I loved information. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that at the time, and I had all these ideas for, hey, we could get rid of the card catalog. And they're looking at me like, are you crazy? Yeah. And I made $14,000 a year. Oh my gosh. And so they made some changes in leadership and I was like, I got to get a better job. Like, I can't do this. And so I had a job offer from WordPerfect and from Novell. And they were both great offers. I was having a hard time deciding which one. I chose the Novell offer and it ended up being perfect for me. So I was there almost 15 years. So I listened to the Fourth Node podcast with not only Bruce, but also Bruce Bastian for WordPerfect because he's my neighbor, but also David and Drew. And these guys were such an important part of the company. So when I first got there, it was the heyday. I mean, it was like young people making a lot of money.
Prime.
Buying big houses. Jaguars, people they didn't know what to do with all this money. And then I noticed it was getting into our neighborhood. So donating computers to schools and making sure they had new carpet. And so all of a sudden, a pretty frothy time. And you didn't have to be that good, really, to make good money because the company was growing. We had a lot of cash. I think at one point there was like $1 billion in cash in the bank because what Dana had said, Dana Russell, who was the CFO eventually, said, look, we could not take another dollar in because of our subscription business and the company could survive for 11 years.
Wow.
Like that was before it was super cool to have that much cash.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, can't someone buy us with our own cash? Like, isn't that a problem? Okay, don't worry about that. But we had partners and Novell was right in the middle of this really cool time. So I was the one that got brain share to where it needed to be. It was a big conference. And we had speakers like Steve Jobs, who spoke 3 or 4 times. We had Jim Canavino from IBM. We had Eric Schmidt, who was at Sun at the time. We had Bill Gates. We had, all of the players, Philippe Kahn from Borland, all of the luminaries from HP and Dell and Microsoft, like they would come and speak at our conference.
Was Novell the first Utah company to put on those big shows? Because now everyone does it. There's Domopalooza. We do one for Entrada.
We were the first. We had it during spring break. And the first one that I did, I called it the second annual. Because everybody felt
it
like
it wasn't actually the first.
It wasn't the first. It was the second annual. And people were like, what? So, because nobody wants to go to a first time show because like, how do you know it's going to be any good? But a second. Yeah. It was at the Red Lion Hotel. And it was.
The Red Lion Hotel. Yeah, that's hilarious.
Second annual.
How many people went?
I think like 100 and some. But. Wow. It was to where it was 10,000 people and we had them all over the world. So we had them in South Africa. We had them in France. We had them in Amsterdam. We had them in Japan. We had them in China. And that conference made more money than a lot of our products because it not only paid for itself, but it generated revenue.
Oh, wow.
And think about the model. Give us money, come stay with us and do it so that we can tell you about our stuff.
Pay us to so we can.
So we did it during spring break at the U. And we had it at the Huntsman Center. And
you did it here. It was always here.
Always here. Even though the conferences we did in other parts of the world, we had those in other parts of the world, but the flagship was always here. And then we take the presentations and take them all over the world. And so I travel with these guys, but you know, like Steve Jobs, like met him so many times, met all these guys so many times. That's what I mean. I'm Forrest Gump. I'm in the pictures, but I'm nobody.
You have a funny Steve Jobs story that cannot remember.
Oh my gosh.
I've heard it. You've got to remind me. What's the funny Steve Jobs story when he came to speak?
So he comes to speak at the Huntsman Center and most of our guests spent the night because a lot of people would go skiing, but he flew in with his entourage. They would come in and out the same day. And so I am 6 months pregnant with my oldest son and we had these baskets made of all these Utah products.
Okay, I'm remembering now.
Yes. Are you sure I can tell this story?
Yes, I want you to tell this story.
So I said to Terry Holbrook, who was my boss, she was the CMO at the time. I said, hey, I really want to make sure that we give this basket to Mr. Jobs. And she's like, just go give it to him on stage. Because, you know, like, go meet him. So I go to him, I'm like, Mr. Jobs, we have this basket for you. Thank you so much for coming to our conference. And we just did this, some things. And he's like, I don't want that. And I'm like, okay, so I'm pivot. I'm like, all right, would it be all right if we donated in your name to a homeless shelter? He's like, I don't care if you shove it up your... And he said, you know. And I was standing there, pregnant, motionless, paralyzed. And I was so taken aback by how like awful that moment was. And Terry said, just take it back in the green room. And so I walked back. I'm so humiliated. And I was so excited. You never want to meet your idols.
Yeah.
So she came in and she just was so mortified. And I just made a note. It's like, okay, not everybody's nice. And so.
That's wild.
But, you know, I got to meet him.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I knew as soon as you brought the name up, I'm like, oh gosh, she has a great story here. I'm
and we kept inviting him and students. We opened it up free for students. So like the place was packed.
That's Huston something the Qualtrics and Domo have continued to do as well as keep let BYU it's and important. The U and send their students for
Christmas. Yeah.
And so, I love that you did it in Utah and kept it here because not a lot of companies do that. It's easier to go to Vegas. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a better draw.
We did it during spring break so people could ski. When we grew out of Huntsman, I said, we got to move to the Salt Palace. And I signed a 10-year contract.
Wow.
With the Salt Palace. And they said they have never done that. I had to move the mosquito abatement people. So I paid them a little money so I could have the dates that I wanted. But it was important for Cornerstone. That company grew off that. It was important
Interesting.
I mean, there were other businesses that grew out of that. And I'm super proud of that project. Drew Major was our headliner every year. And we finally stopped doing it, we had these styrofoam characters that were like 20 feet tall. He's like, can I take a chainsaw to him? I'm like, you can do whatever you want, my friend.
So did you come up in events then? Is that what you got hired by Novell to do?
No, I was hired to do international marketing.
Okay.
So I left the library, took this job at international marketing. And so Novell had business in Latin America, in Asia, and Europe. And so I was one of the first hires. And my first project was the SEs wanted to go to a 4-city tour in Latin America and have a 1-day conference. Mm-hmm. So I set that up with a partner, Arnaldo C. Castro. I mean, you remember the weirdest things. And it was in Mexico City, in Caracas, Venezuela, in Sao Paulo, and then in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Interesting.
So 4 big markets. We had the team put together, just a few SEs, and we had some international folks. And I had this idea to have all the slides translated into Spanish. So I hired this little company, Aprovo, translated everything, had my husband like proof it. And so then when we got there, everything was in Spanish and they were so delighted. And
that's cool.
That's when I got the opportunity to start doing more and more things because I could think of things that would delight the customer.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about like the post-glory days of Novell. I've heard a lot of stories from you and people like Dana Russell. Like when Ray left, Eric came in, then Eric bails to go to a little company called Google. There was the company kind of hit turmoil, like a bunch of CEOs. Yeah. Like what were those? What was kind of that next like 10 years like after Ray and Eric were no longer there?
So, you know, Microsoft started coming after us and it started to get harder and harder. We had built a pretty nice partner ecosystem. So we worked with all the partners, which throughout the rest of my career ended up being a theme for every company that I went to.
Yeah.
Even today. That when you can figure out a way to work with partners, that you can build your revenue a lot faster. But once Ray left, and Ray was so lovely, like he was so amazing. My office was right next to his, and he was so good to just everyone. He was tough.
I wish I'd met him. I never met him.
Yeah, he was tough. We had to kind of solve around some. Like he would never fly first class, and which is okay. But we had signed a partnership with Japan for Novell KK, and I had a big event to ribbon cutting and everything. And we had to keep changing it because he kept canceling. And I was like, this is so frustrating because I got SoftBank, Sonsan, I thought he was like this gamer dude. Mm-hmm. And I got a Christmas gift from him. And they're like, no, he actually is the president of SoftBank. And I'm like, okay, so my mistake. but it kept canceling. So finally, I went to his chief of staff and said, look, I'm super frustrated. If he doesn't want to go, he said, Karen, he will never go. I'm like, okay, why? His brother was killed in Pearl Harbor.
Okay. Oh,
that makes sense to me. Like I would
never. He wouldn't tell you. He wouldn't say it.
Mm-mm. No, I don't think he even didn't know. I think he just.
It was like, just kind of subconsciously a thing for him. Wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, but truly such an amazing man when he would speak. Like he was so presidential and yet, you know, he drove a truck and he treated everyone like he was treated everyone the same. Really loved Drew and those guys because they came in at an important time and probably saved the company.
Drew and David said something very similar, by the way. Like, just loved him. And they did mention he drove a truck. truck as well.
Yeah, big gray truck, big Ford truck. And he paid attention to what you drove. And he, we had one event where we over-ordered. It was PC Expo. The fellas didn't get it right on the podcast. It's PC Expo. And there were these chocolate donuts that they had ordered for the press conference, and there were extras. And so when we're done, he's putting them under the table because we had another event the next morning. And I was like, oh my gosh, thank you so much. We can't do that. Like convention services, like it's a union. And so I told the team, it's fine. Just let him go. You know, because we had to throw him out. But he was just so careful with money. And that's why Nobel did so well.
Yeah.
But as the chain, like the guard kept changing. So,
Why did Ray leave? Was he fired? Did he leave on his own?
No.
Did it help start to affect him?
So after the merger were perfect and Novell, that was his deal.
Yeah.
Then he was not young.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It was not young. And I think that he had set up the perpetual education fund. I mean, he had done some really great things with his money.
Okay.
It's time to change. So, you know, Marenghi was a sales guy. So Joe Marenghi came in through an acquisition. He went on to do great things at Dell, but it just got hard in the company. And the company kind of lost its way. Bob Frankenberg came in, another great CEO. And then Eric Schmidt came in. I worked for Eric. So I worked for every one of the CEOs except for Ron Hovhaussapien, who was the last guy.
Okay.
And they all were very different. They all, had good things to do for the company, but the company just kind of lost its way. It just got harder and harder and harder. And then when the company acquired Cambridge Software, it was like the snake ate the rat, but the rat ate through the snake. So it got really crazy after that.
Was that like late 90s? Early
that was 2000 and 2001, 2002. Okay. And here's this little tiny company that was coming in and all the leadership and the CEO, Jack Messman, had been on the board. But when you're on the board, you're not operating. Like you really don't understand where all the organs are in the company. And so their focus was to alienate the real cash cows for the company and invest everything in the future, but they picked the wrong future. So it just kind of struggled for a bit.
Interesting.
And so I think they finally found their way and there was plenty of cash. So when you're doing well, it hides a lot of problems.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I still have such an affinity to the company because a lot of young people had great jobs and great opportunity. And they really, if I look at a lot of the founders that have gone on to companies, they cut their teeth at Novell and they learned a lot of, I mean, I was in my 20s and I had these big jobs doing things all over the world. And, Delta, you passed the 2 million mile, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. 3 million miles.
There you go. You hit three.
Yeah. And the flight attendant's like, Mrs. Clark, we never have a female 3 million miler ever, even with credit cards spent. And I was like, do I win something? Or and, it's because of those early days flying all over the world and just dragging my homework with me and dragging all my stuff with me.
Let's talk about that for a minute. So, we've done a bunch of research to figure out who to get on this podcast. All these companies that were started in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. The reality is there were just no women there.
No.
You really, like Susan Peterson, I heard her say this phrase talking about you. She said she crawled through glass so that the rest of us could run.
Oh, that's so nice.
Tell us about what that was like for you. You really were, you were the only executive in those days, at least for Utah companies, not outside, but just tell us what it was like at the time as you were, think about that, your mark and kind of what you've done.
People ask me about it, especially when they find out that I'm the chairman of the board for Domo, because they're like, really? And I'm like, I know. It's okay. The world's still going to be okay. When I graduated from MBA school, so I was already at Novell for a number of years. I graduated from MBA school, BYU. It was 1993. And the colonel, my father, and Mrs. Colonel, my mom, they came to my graduation. And my dad, I got a hug from him the day I was married. Like, that should tell you everything you need to know. He said, your mother and I are very proud of you. And I was like, thank you so much, sir. And he said, but you need to understand something. You're going to have to work harder to be equal. You're not going to be paid as much. It's going to be awful. So for you to progress in your career, you're going to have to be better than everyone else just to be equal. So don't be bugged. Be better.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what is he talking about? And then I figured out what he's talking about.
Yeah.
So And I tell a lot of women, look, I've hired, think of how many people I've hired in my career. And mm-hmm. if I'm the CEO, I'm hiring the top jobs, right? Not one time has a woman tried to negotiate her salary or ask for a signing bonus. Not one time really? In the thousands of people that I've hired in my career, not one woman has said, so you could say, well, maybe because I give them great offers and I'm really mm-hmm. good about it. And I index around what I think they need.
Sure.
But I got dudes who are like, I need $50,000 signing bonus. And I'm like, hell no. And they're like, okay. I mean, it's like, so a lot of times I think that women, it's on us because we don't apply, because we don't ask, because we don't push, because we don't see ourselves in those roles, because we don't, even when they said, look, we'd like to have you consider you for the chairman of the board. First thing I thought was, oh no. First of all, that could give me brain damage. And second of all, like, no, like that's not fun. But then my husband said, you know, there aren't many female chairmen of publicly traded tech companies, so you have to do it.
Mm.
And so he's like, other people need to see that this is okay. So I would apply for jobs. I would push through. I would do everything I could to just even be considered. And I never blamed it on anyone else because the colonel said, don't be bugged. Like if I didn't get it, I was like, don't be bugged, be better.
Yeah. I'm sure you've seen change over the last 30 years, but has it changed fast enough for you?
No, it hasn't, but maybe it's changed as fast as it could.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. I think it takes a long time. And I tell women, look, if you're not qualified for the job, still apply because yeah. your brothers are, mm-hmm. right? The mm-hmm. brothers are like, oh, I'm 10% qualified. Dude, I can do that job. Right. But I think women think they have to be 100% qualified. And we do this to ourselves. I see a lot of women who don't speak up and they have an opinion and they have a voice and then they leave the meeting and then they're bugged and they have the meeting after the meeting. And so when they come to me, they're like, bah, 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 bah. I'm like, nope, no meeting after the meeting. If you're not going to say it in the meeting, then I don't want to hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we don't challenge each other enough. I think that a lot of women get on their heels and they don't feel like they can keep going with an argument.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm relying on people like you, Adam. I know you do a good job of this, of mining for conflict and getting those voices out and not only opening a door for someone, but pushing them through it.
Yeah.
And that's Greg Butterfield did that for me. When we were at Altiris, we were acquired by Symantec and there was the CMO was leaving her job to go run the business, the consumer business unit. And Greg's like, I want you to apply for that job. I was like, nope. This is like a $7 billion company, like a publicly traded company. Mm-hmm. And Altiris was publicly traded, but not at the scale of Symantec.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like so much pressure to do it. And I was like, no, dude, I don't want to do that. And he not only opened the door, but he shoved me through it. And really? I got the job. And then I was like, oh, now I got to do it. Like it was rough. But I give him credit for that because he wouldn't let me bow out. He's like, if you don't do it, we're going to shut down the site in Utah and 600 people lose their job.
Yeah. And he would have been right.
And I was like, oh my gosh.
Wow.
But I had I did that job and I was good at that job, but I didn't ever see myself that way. And we got to fix that. It's not going fast enough, but I need more women to stay on the conveyor belt
mm-hmm.
and they don't because it's tough. Like you got to be pretty. You got to have a lot of steel to stay on the belt.
And do you feel like, I mean, you've done business all over the world, so many different industries. Do you feel like, you know, there's a part of it that's a Utah thing or an industry thing, or it's, you know, worldwide, global? There are different elements or scales to this based on some of the factors we have right here in the state? Or like, how do you perceive that? You just have such an interesting vantage point.
I think it's pretty unique in Utah. But I do think it's all over the world. So I went to Japan early in my career and I was the lead person. So my Nobel KK work, I was the lead and I had an interpreter assigned to me and they would only listen to my sidekick who was the guy that was helping me get stuff done. But like, the colonel was right. Don't be bugged. Just keep going.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Just, I was in China, same thing. It surprises me today when it still happens to me. So I was in a meeting. Adam knows I know how to do product stuff. And so the guy in the meeting doesn't know him. And he's like, so, you know, in code, he's explaining it to me. And I'm like, I'm really trying so hard not to be offended.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Because you're a lovely man, but dude, you're a moron. Because, and you don't want people to feel bad, but we got to break through. We got to have courage over comfort to say things when it's not okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, to your point, like I've known you for 12 years. We've spent hundreds of hours talking about this kind of stuff, but even just this conversation, what what made you who you are, what made me who I am, is we got at bats. We got opportunity. And for you to, I hadn't heard that story about Greg kind of pushing you into that CMO position at Symantec and making you go apply for that. That's what we all need to be doing, regardless of your gender. If you're in a leadership position, everyone needs at bats. That's the only way to learn how to do this stuff. The only way to learn how to raise money is to raise money in a crappy way. The only way to know how to run a board meeting is to go run some shitty board meetings.
Get the scar tissue.
To hire people. You got to go hire, make a bunch of bad hires, and then you'll figure it out.
It was the same thing with when I came to Allegiance. Mm-hmm. So Greg was chairman of the board, or he was just a board member. And you were looking for some help. And you and I had lunch together. I even have the picture when we had lunch together the first time at Happy Sumo. And Greg's like, hey, I really want you to. So I had done most of my cancer stuff, or I was through the worst treatment. He's like, you need to leave. You need to come be the CEO of this company. I'm like, oh no. Like, I've never done. I was like, not even within the realm of possibility for me. He's like, this company's special. It's right in your strike zone, and you will love Adam. And I'm like, dude, he's a founder. He does not need me. Most fun thing in my career was hanging out with you. Dealing with really weird people. You know exactly what I'm talking about.
We got along well. Give us a few minutes on Alteris. We haven't introduced that company to this podcast yet. And I don't think people realize there was $1 billion+ publicly traded business right after 9/11 IPO. Like, give us the story on Alteris.
So at Novell, right after the Cambridge acquisition, 6 months pregnant with triplets.
Wow.
And the new CMO, who doesn't know me from anyone, and I'm driving all the campaigns, I'm driving a ton of stuff, and I'm pushing, like, let's not alienate NetWare group-wise. Like, these are massive. Group-wise was $120 million no matter what you did. You could set that thing on fire, still $120 million. Like, the best cash cow ever. NetWare was almost $1 billion itself. Mm. And they wanted to take everything away from it. I'm like, we can't do that. And so I was pretty... courage over comfort. I was pretty vocal, and she didn't like that. So she's like, look, we're going to eliminate your position. And I already saw it coming. So I'm like, here are my terms. And the funniest part was I said, look, I'm 6 months pregnant with triplets. She's like, you are not. And I was like, wow, I can actually prove it. So when I left Novell, I left with a pretty nice setup. And Jan Newman, who had been the founder of Alteris, but was now biz dev, and he had brought Greg Butterfield in. He said, hey, why don't you come help us at Alteris? And I'm like, I'm 6 months pregnant. Like, let me just go off into the sunset, and I'm probably going to lose two of these babies. And he's like, look, we will do anything to have you come and help us build our newest partnership, which was Dell. And I had a lot of great relationships at Dell. So Joe Marenghi, who was my CEO, he was running all of the sales organization. So I said, yep, I'll come and do it. They said, look, we'll cover your maternity.
Joe went to Alteris?
Joe was from Novell, so was Jan, but Joe went to Dell.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And he had like a $13 billion quota. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was like a really big deal there. Mm-hmm. So I came to Alteris, and I took a third of my pay to come to Alteris. Took a stock position. I sat in a cubicle. No staff, no budget, no office, no nothing. And people were like, what is going on? My husband's like, I think she's lost her mind because she's pregnant and let's just leave her alone. But I knew exactly what I was doing because I saw the potential of the position of the company, because their products could handle all software migrations, could handle all asset management. And the way they were talking about it, as lifecycle management. And so I'm like, Jan, no one goes to bed at night and says, oh, I can't sleep because of my life cycle management problems. You know, you look at it from the customer's perspective. So he's like, just build the Dell relationship for us. So I called Joe Marenghi and I'm like, here's the deal. You sell our software, I'll give you a buck a node. You manage it. You tell me what I owe you. 100%. Super simple. He's like, a buck a node? I'm like, yeah. So on the Navy Marine Corps deal, it's 350,000 users. Your sales guy makes $350,000 on the software. He's like, ooh, that's pretty rich. And I'm like, I make $35, so happy to pay a buck a node. So framed it all up. Mm. Joe loved it, but EMC did not love it. Mm. So we ended up never executing it, but we got their attention. So I stayed there 3 months, and Greg Butterfield comes to my office and he's like, you make me nervous.
Did you know Butterfield from before?
I knew who he was, but he didn't know me.
Oh, okay. Mm. Okay.
He comes to my cubicle. He's like, you're kind of a big deal. Why are you in a cubicle? Why aren't you in an office? Why do you don't even have a title? I'm like, So good, sir. So good. And he later he came to me. He said, "You knew exactly what you were doing. You were rolling the dice on your skills. You knew that we wouldn't let you just sit in a cubicle. You knew that you would be on executive staff. Like, you knew that." And he's like, "I have so much respect for someone who's willing to lose to win." Because I knew what I could do for the company. So the company hadn't gone public yet. The company went public soon after I joined. I had nothing to do with it. It was all Greg and Jan.
It was like 02, 03, right? Like 02. The world had just kind of...
Yeah, and it was the first software company to go public in like 18 months. I mean, wow. Jan could tell you. And the stock price just totally plummeted. Like everyone thought, oh, they've lost their mind. But we just kept chipping away, kept doing what you do every day, which is sales and more partners and marketing. And it was... The original leadership team was the original leadership team the entire time.
That's rare.
So yeah, it's super rare. And I was the only woman on executive staff.
And all
staff.
Utah people.
All Utah people. Dwayne pretty much. Here, yeah. And
Butters,
yeah.
You.
Jan. And Jan. So Jan really taught me what it meant to lose to win because he was the founder of the company. And he got it to where he needed someone that had the Greg Butterfield touch because Greg was a salesman. And so Jan stepped aside and Jan, I think, made more money on the deal than Greg, but Jan was willing to lose to win. They had a great partnership.
Yeah.
They had a great partner. And they pushed each other.
Yeah.
But I still see it today because Jan's at Lumio and I still see the push and pull that the two of them have and how they trust each other and how they're loyal to each other. And that's
very
like
cool.
The best part, really, is that you have people that you trust who have your back, who will push you. So Altiris was great. We acquired a lot of companies. I think maybe even 40 companies we acquired.
Oh, wow.
So,
I forgot about that aspect of your growth story.
We grew so fast and we had 3 downstream acquisitions that were all queued up, ready to go at the end of 2006. It would have doubled the size of the company. And Greg had worked really hard to get these 3 acquisitions lined up. We're going to announce them all at once. And then there was an offer from Novell to buy the company that Greg did not want to have happen, but the board would probably take.
Mm-hmm.
So Greg, and this was like a master stroke. So it's December of 2006. He calls John Thompson, who was the chairman of Symantec, who ended up, he became the chairman of Microsoft. And he says to him, "Look, we've met a couple times. You talk about your endpoints. The most secure endpoint is a well-managed endpoint. You don't have that today. You buy us, you have it. We're 100% accretive to your business." So John flew out 2 days later to Utah. And here comes this white stretch limousine and this black man gets out. I'm like, could they have been a little more conspicuous? Like, could we just have like a regular driver? Like, why has it got to be a white stretch limousine? He came, he talked to the company. We started diligence and we did diligence all through the holidays. And we all signed a nobody could speak about it.
Yeah. I mean, you're public at this point.
Never,
so you can't leak.
Never got out. And so we had our sales meeting in January. We're up in Salt Lake, huddled around the conference phone to have a call with John Thompson. And he says, "My board does not support this move because we missed our number, but I'm going to do it anyway." And so at the end of January, we announced that Altiris was being acquired by Symantec and that deal closed in April. And
1.3?
I think so.
1.3 billion or so?
Yeah.
It was in that range.
We had a bunch of cash with 800 million. And John Thompson was in our offices the day that we were talking to Wall Street. And I'm sitting next to him. So it's 3:30 in the morning, early. And he's in his suit with his cufflinks. And I'm like, "Hey, no offense, but dude, why are you here?" He's like, "The biggest deal I'd ever signed was Veritas. And this is the second biggest deal. And this deal was done on a handshake with Mr. Butterfield. And it's important for me to support him today."
That's cool.
And I was like, "Where'd you get those presidential cufflinks?" Like, seal the president. Because I'm making small talk, right? He and I had become great friends. But he's like, "Yeah, I forgot my cufflinks. These are just rolling around in my dop kit." And I'm like, "You and I are very different people, my friend." But he was so great to work with.
Altiris, it's such a cool story. It's one that when we started this, I wanted to make sure was not forgotten. Like, I don't think people realize in 2006, 2007, companies in Utah were not worth $1 billion.
Yeah.
That was rare. Very rare.
I mean, it made a lot of wealthy people out of that company. A lot of people went on to do other things. And these were people who were like just regular people. It wasn't like these were professional executives that had great pedigrees from great colleges. These were just like
a lot of you went
JD
on.
JD Brisk.
I mean, Fusion.io was a lot of Altiris. Like, I mean, Novell sprung out a bunch of companies and then, you know, Altiris sprung out
a whole new batch.
Yeah, and it was pretty much Jan and Greg. I mean, Greg brought in the whole partnering strategy. So we started with Compaq, HP, Dell, and then at the end of it, we had contracts with every single hardware manufacturer in the planet, all the big companies. Mm-hmm. And that's Symantec wanted that. And Symantec wanted, and it ended up, they called us the Utah Mafia because a lot of the Altiris executives took roles inside of Symantec that were pretty big.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it was like a joke. Oh, here comes Utah Mafia again. And John Thompson said, there's something about you guys from Utah. Like, he said, I think it's integrity, but you always know what to do. You are kind. You're humble. You never take the bait and you want everyone else to win. Hmm. He's like, what is it? I'm like, let's just go with integrity. That's a good one.
Altiris was one of the ones early on when we started looking into all the research. Novell, WordPerfect, Altiris, that there's almost like this family tree that just spreads and spreads and spreads. And it does seem like there's so many that came out of Altiris, but it's never talked about really. And it's also in a bit of a phase in Utah Tech where there wasn't a ton of other companies that were started and exited at that exact time.
Yeah, like I think you had Omniture,
maybe a couple others. Yeah. But
and maybe Greg was on the board of Omniture.
He was.
Yeah.
And like, because you can see the tentacles.
Altiris kind of filled that gap between a WordPerfect and Novell, and then before Omniture, and then, you know, Qualtrics and everything.
Came in,
yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Altiris really was the player here for that decade. We're going to have you back because we didn't even address a lot of things. But maybe to wrap up, I know you speak at a lot of colleges, you mentor a lot of kids, so I'm sure you have this on the tip of your tongue, but I think, you know, a lot of our listeners are young. What's your advice to people that are just starting their careers or where you were at in the early 90s and where I was at 20 years ago, like just trying to figure life out? What's your advice to them?
So too many times we let fear determine our fate. We're too afraid to try something. We're too afraid to do something. We're too afraid to challenge something. We're too afraid to go up to John Thompson. We're too afraid. We see Josh James, we see Greg Butterfield, we see Ryan Smith. We're too afraid to go up to them and talk to them. We're too afraid to do anything. And then we look back and we're like, I never had any opportunity. I never had this chance. I tell people, look, there really is something to courage over comfort. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean don't be afraid. It means do it anyway. Mm-hmm. And the way I got past it, because I was paralyzingly shy when I was a young person, is that I would say to myself, what's the worst thing that can happen? And then I fill in all those, you know, crazy stories. And then I end it with, can I survive it? And I know I can survive anything now. Mm-hmm. So I know I can survive it. And all of the mistakes I've made, all of the hard times, all of the times when I either lost my job or I thought I was losing my way, it has given me scar tissue that's so valuable to me that I honor that. And I try to push young people. I try to open the door for people and shove them through it. Mm-hmm. And I ask a lot of questions. They're like, oh, I want to start my own company. I'm like, why don't you start your own company? What's holding you back? Well, you know, what? So either do it or stop talking about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, when Ryan Smith went public the first time, how many bites of the apple does that guy get?
Yeah, he's on his third apple.
He's already eaten two.
The first time he went public, I sent him a text and I said, congratulations for your 16-year overnight success. Because people didn't see him in the basement. People didn't see him with his dad. People didn't see him like trying to get his, and I, you know, I'm a big fan of his because he does everything his own way. But they don't see Josh James trying to make payroll at Omniture. They don't see Adam Edmonds trying to keep the customers together. They don't see, everyone thinks it's super easy for everyone. And it's not. It's hard. It's going to suck. You're going to like, how do we make it through it? And when you look back, you're like, wow, look what we built. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just trying to get people, just do it anyway. Just go. If you make a mistake, recalibrate, pivot. Like when you do it, when there's small mistakes and you don't have big mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's really nothing special about me. I just really took to heart what the Colonel said about just be better. And when I got knocked, I'm just like, pop right back up and pop right back up. And I need more people to do that, especially young women, especially young people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Beautifully said.
Very well said.
Guys, this is so fun. Thanks for, am I the first girl on the podcast?
Yes.
We're very excited to have this conversation.
Well, we'll get more on there, but it's, we can do better, but we will do better.
Well, thank you, my friend. You've meant a lot to me. Appreciate you having me on.
Oh, thank you both.
Thanks, Green.